This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, August 8th, 2008. I'm Sarah Campbell in for Curtis Fox. This week, the mixed messages of Mao Zedong. The Olympics are in Beijing, and millions of eyes are on China. But I doubt if we're going to be seeing much of Mao, despite the fact that he was such a major figure in the country up until his death in 1976. Among other things, Mao is remembered for ordering mass executions and for the Cultural Revolution and the decades of violence that it spawned. Mao killed a lot of people. He was also a poet, and some scholars, such as Willis Barnstone, say that he was a good poet.
Mao was certainly the best poet of his time.
Barnstone translated Mao's poetry into English in 1972. That book is being republished this month by the University of California Press. When he was in power, Mao's poetry got a lot of airtime, for obvious reasons.
During the Cultural Revolution, his poetry was every place, written on little grains of rice, on walls, on postage stamps, and even when I went back for a year to China in 84 and 5, there was study hour when the students had to spend an hour every day studying the poems of Mao, which by then they hated to do.
They may have hated it, but they had to read Mao in those days. But what about now? Is his poetry really that good, or are we reading it because Mao wrote it?
As far as it being just because it was Mao, no, I don't think so. I really don't.
Well, I definitely wouldn't be writing about his poetry if he weren't who he was.
Rachel Aviv has an essay about Mao's poetry this month on our website, poetryfoundation.org.
I'm not sure that his poetry stands alone. I think it's impressive technically, but it doesn't strike me as particularly original.
Mao's poetry tends to get these two responses. Some people, like Barnstone, view Mao as a great poet. Others see him as a major historical figure who happened to write poetry. I asked both of them to read the poem Snow. It's one of Mao's best-known poems. Here's a bit of how it sounds in Chinese.
沁园春雪北国风光千里冰封万里雪飘望长城内外
Snow. The scene is the Northlands. Thousands of li sealed in ice. 10,000 li in blowing snow.
From the long wall, I gaze inside and beyond and see only vast tundra. Up and down the yellow river, the gurgling water is frozen. Mountains dance like silver snakes. Hills gallop like wax bright elephants, trying to climb over the sky.
On days of sunlight, the planet teases us in her white dress and rouge. Rivers and mountains are beautiful, and made heroes bow and compete to catch the girl, lovely Earth. Yet the emperors Shi Huang and Wu Di were barely able to write. The first emperors of the Tang and Song dynasties were crude. Genghis Khan, man of his epoch and favored by heaven, knew only how to hunt the great eagle. They are all gone. Only today are we men of feeling.
That was the poem Snow by Mao, translated by Willis Barnstone. Barnstone says he loves the poem's extraordinary imagery,
which goes back to references which an educated Chinese would know, and if the person doesn't know, the lines are still extraordinarily beautiful. The mountains dance like silver snakes. Hills gallop like wax bright elephants trying to climb over the sky. These are fantastic, almost surreal images, which are very common in Chinese.
To me, those images don't seem so extraordinary.
To be fair, Rachel Aviv is thinking of another set of images in the poem. These images.
On days of sunlight, the planet teases us in her white dress and rouge. Rivers and mountains are beautiful, and made heroes bow and compete to catch the girl, lovely Earth.
The idea of nature as a seductive woman is something that you see in so much poetry. It's predictable. It seems to me like there's nothing that's really out of line with what one would expect.
On the other hand, Mao's poetry is not at all what we'd expect from him. His poetry sounds nothing like the kind of Marxist writing he called for. Mao writes very traditional, classical Chinese verse. His language is refined, and the poems are loaded with mythical allusions. But he wanted everyone else in China to write in common speech and to avoid the old forms. He said the old style would cramp their thought. He even at one point told younger writers not to use his poetry as a model.
Mao permitted this formal kind of poetry with references to traditional poetry only to himself during his main years. He said he was too old in a kind of uncertain modesty to write in any other way. However, other people could not do this. They had to do a kind of unfriendly social realism. It's almost a kind of madness.
This madness produced a lot of poetry. During the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s, China decided that poems should be mass-produced the same way other national goods were. So to boost literary production, poem collectors were dispatched into factories and farms to gather poems and songs from the workers while they worked the machines. The results? Well, here's an example.
Each year, our farm production grows. Grains and cotton pile up mountain high. Hurrah! Eat the grains, but don't forget the sower. The Communist Party's our dear Ma and Pa.
This approach to poetry production failed, along with the effort to produce tons of steel and grain. And as with so many of Mao's policies, it was the people who suffered. The Great Leap Forward contributed to what may be the largest famine in human history, killing somewhere between 20 and 72 million Chinese peasants. Mao's brutal impact on China makes it difficult to read his poetry without thinking about the man who wrote these poems.
I found this problem as I was writing about Mao. Every time I tried to write about his poetry, I found myself drawing away from it and writing about him, and I couldn't get myself to focus on the actual language and just to write about the poetry. And for some reason, in the end, it sort of bored me a little bit. I think most people probably read Mao's poems to find out insights about who he was, not necessarily because they want to read his poetry.
So what are those insights? Well, there's the one we've already heard, that Mao was a hypocrite and that he didn't practice the kind of poetry that he preached. But there's something else in his poetry, too, like in the last lines of Snow, where the poem takes a turn and shows us Mao's appetite for disruption. He rejects the old order of things and replaces it with himself and calls it we.
The first emperors of the Tang and Song dynasties were crude. Genghis Khan, man of his epoch and favored by heaven, knew only how to hunt the great eagle. They are all gone. Only today are we men of feeling.
The last line, the only today are we men of feeling, he often ends on this general note of this is the most poetic generation. Only today can we find real poets. This sense of turning back, giving a synopsis of history really quickly and then showing why today everything is different and we're in a totally new world.
It offers a notion of that enthusiasm which Mao tried to instill in others, which is often a very dangerous enthusiasm, kind of almost ecstatic terror.
Willis Barnstone is the translator of The Poems of Mao Zedong, reissued this month by the University of California Press. And you can find Rachel Aviv's article about Mao's poetry on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Email us and let us know what you think of this program. Our address is podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this podcast comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Sarah Campbell. Curtis Fox will be back soon. Thanks for listening.